Lecture 18, Shakespeare, Julius Caesar.
In our last lecture, we examined the Gulag Archipelago of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, a book I believe to be one of the most powerful works of the 20th century, and one that will continue to speak to the 21st century. It is the work of a writer, of an individual of enormous conscience, duty, and responsibility, who, despite terror and the experience of prison and labor camp and torture, believed it his duty to speak out and his responsibility to ensure that the millions who suffered in these labor camps of Stalin would have their voice. It is a work of honor. And that continues to be our theme today in this lecture, honor. Honor. Honor, duty, and responsibility. For they are central to how we live our lives if we wish to live them as thoughtful individuals. But you see, duty, honor, responsibility, we can define them. How can we live them? We all think we know what our duty is. And yet, when we want to put that into practice, it becomes conflicting. Is your duty what your company tells you to do? Is it what your profession tells you to do? Or is duty something that you have inside you that your conscience tells you to do? Responsibility. Yes, you have a responsibility to speak the truth, to do your duty, but you also have a responsibility to your family. You have a responsibility to your country. You have a responsibility to the company that pays you. And finally, honor. Honor. It is a word that we use today constantly. And it is a word, or an ideal, that has no effective meaning in today's society. Honor lived in the 19th century. Robert E. Lee could say, "I wish no other flag than the Stars and Stripes. I wish no other anthem than Hail Columbia. I wish no other country than the United States of America. There is nothing I would not give up to save the Union except honor." And men fought and died in the Civil War for honor. But today, if someone tells you, or someone you're negotiating with, and you hear about that person, why he or she is an honorable person, you better watch out, because that has no meaning whatsoever. Honor is a sense of right and wrong. It is a reputation for integrity, bravery, for doing what must be done. And honor is both validated from the outside. People have to believe you have honor, and you must also believe inside you that you have honor. Honor is part of your person. It is an element of property that can be stripped away from you. And to the true man or woman of honor, such a stripping away of honor is to lose what is most essential to you. That is why, now you're going to laugh at this, but there's truth in it. Honor can only exist in an age which takes the duel seriously. The founders of our country spoke of their sacred honor. In fact, in the Declaration of Independence, that is the only one of the we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor that has an adjective to it. They were men of honor, as were the men of the Civil War. And Alexander Hamilton is one of those who died in a duel. Now, we don't duel today, do we? Somebody says something bad about you, you take them to court. The lawyer is the alternative to the duel, and it is the antithesis of the concept of honor. Not that lawyers aren't wonderful people, it's simply that the system that we work under is the antithesis of a system based upon honor. But our play, Julius Caesar, has as its central theme honor. It is a play all about honor, presented to an audience in an age that took honor seriously. It was produced in 1599 by that world genius William Shakespeare, whose Othello we have already studied, that master of human reality as it is, not presenting us with ideals, but presenting us with men and women the way they really behave and what motivates them. Jealousy in the Othello, love, which is the counterpart of jealousy, and in Julius Caesar, honor, duty, courage, and ambition. Those are our central themes that motivate the great characters, and above all, the powerful image of Marcus Junius Brutus. Produced in 1599, it marked the end of Shakespeare's concern with English history and the start of a series of plays based upon the lives of Plutarch, of the noble Greeks and Romans, that work which in our famous Greeks and Romans we saw to be one of the most influential and one of the greatest works ever composed. And Shakespeare admired it enormously. He admired it in a French and then English translation and took it as the base for this great play, the Julius Caesar, basing his account very closely on the life of Julius Caesar in Plutarch, but adding those qualities that Shakespeare uses to turn it into a monumental statement of values that endure in our own age and human actions. Julius Caesar is the title figure, and you know from famous Romans how much I admire Julius Caesar. To my mind, he is the greatest statesman ever to live, a man of enormous vision and courage, a man of genius, who amidst a busy life composed works of history, his commentaries, to describe his victories in Gaul that are the finest example of Latin prose ever written. A military genius who didn't begin to command until he was 39 years of age and then never lost a battle, conquering the whole of Gaul. And a statesman who envisioned Rome not as a narrow republic, ruling an empire for its own gratification, but as a world state, ruling from Britain all the way out to Iraq and from the sands of the Sahara to the North Sea, in which every inhabitant of that empire enjoyed personal liberty, the freedom to live as they chose, the freedom to follow their own occupation, to make money and to be prosperous, all equal under the magisterial rule of great Caesar. And Caesar is a world historical force. And like a world historical force, we cannot judge him by the values of ordinary life. Many a beautiful little flower must be trampled underfoot before a great figure like Caesar. War, why, in the conquest of Gaul, Plutarch tells us that Caesar killed 1 million Gauls, sold 1 million into slavery, and left 1 million free to become good Roman citizens. And you might ask, what had the Gauls done to be invaded? Well, they had to be invaded, because the demands of empire justified it, and history would justify it. So the French today are deeply proud of Caesar and his great conquest that created the nation of France. And there were those, as is true of any great man, who saw Caesar differently. There were those who saw him not as a mighty world-transforming figure, but as a man of cunning, deceit, as a petty little politician who would do anything to achieve his ambition, and that ambition was dictatorship, the destruction of Roman liberty, the destruction of that constitution based upon a balance between a Roman assembly of the ordinary people and the majesty of the Senate. Some had given their lives rather than to accept the rule of great Caesar. He had waded by this view to power, absolute power, through the blood of Pompey. The soldiers who had fought for Pompey on the field of Pharsalus in 48 BC. And great Cato, Marcus Porcius Cato, had committed suicide rather than accept a high post in Caesar's new government. Our scene, first scene, opens in the year 44 BC. February the 15th, 44 B.C., 1 month before the Ides of March in Rome. And Shakespeare has telescoped the chronology so that we find crowds out in the street celebrating Caesar's great victories over Pompey and over Cato. And it begins with a bit of humor. Tribunes of the people, those ancient defenders of the liberty of the ordinary Roman citizen, outraged at the crowds who are now saluting Caesar. And they point out, you cobbler there, and all the rest of you merrymakers with your breath that smells so bad and your foul clothes, why are you out in the streets celebrating Caesar's victory? Why, Caesar is a great man. Yes, and not long ago you were celebrating Pompey. And what a great man he is. How fickle you are. And believe me, William Shakespeare is not a fan of democracy. He does not believe that ordinary people have the sense, the goodwill, even the values to govern themselves. His play King John manages to tell the whole story of King John without ever once referring to the Magna Carta, as I believe. And he lived in a time when England was enjoying prosperity under one of its firmest monarchs, under Queen Elizabeth. So democracy, as it is embodied in these foul-mouthed, ordinary people, has been the ruin of Rome, because it is precisely this kind of uneducated mob that will welcome every would-be dictator as long as they fill their pockets and fill their stomachs and give them entertainment. In other words, free cable TV, you might say, and unlimited Big Macs would be the way to power in ancient Rome. We then encounter Brutus and Cassius. It is a critical moment in the political life of Rome, for on this day, February the 15th, is celebrated the ancient ritual of the Lupercalia, a ritual that went all the way back to the days when Rome was founded by Romulus, a day on which the consul and other officials of the year run around only with a loincloth around them and strike women with wolf's hide and milk. And if a woman wants to be fertile, to have a child, she steps forward to be lashed with the wolf's hide dipped in milk, an ancient ritual. But on this day, it's going to have a special meaning. For Caesar has set up an operation by which, at the conclusion of the Lupercalia, before the assembled people of Rome, his friend and close associate, Mark Antony, will offer him the crown, the coronet, the diadem, as the Romans called it. And he will become king over the Romans. He is already dictator for life. The ancient Roman republics realized that you might be in situations in which there was a need for absolute power, but it had to be limited for 6 months. Caesar is dictator for life. But it's not enough. He has the ambition to be king. His honor demands to be king. It is dishonorable for Caesar to have so much power and for the Roman people not to make him king. That is an insult to him. And he has the courage to accept the royal coronet. But Brutus has not gone to the celebrations. He does not have the taste for it. Instead, he is standing outside the sacred area and has fallen into conversation, not accidentally, with Cassius, Gaius Cassius Longinus. Marcus Junius Brutus, very different from Cassius. Cassius, for starters, is lean and hungry. Thin, a dangerous man. He comes from a fairly ordinary Roman aristocratic family, unlike Marcus Junius Brutus, whose ancestry goes right back to the foundation of the Roman Republic, whose ancestor was Lucius Junius Brutus, that stern-eyed republican who drove the last king, the last man to dare to wish to be king, out of Rome, who held up the bleeding body of Lucretia and forced the Roman people to swear an oath that never again would they allow the word king to be said in Rome, that it would become the most hateful of ideas to them to have a king. Lucius Junius Brutus, who established the consulship, that very embodiment of the idea of limits upon power, and who executed his own son for plotting against the liberty of the Roman people. That was the ancestor of great Marcus Junius Brutus. And his father-in-law, the father of his wife, Portia? Why, his father-in-law was Marcus Porcius Cato, who had killed himself rather than accept the gratitude and the salary and the promotion by Caesar. Brutus is different. He has indeed fought for Pompey on the field of Pharsalus, and Caesar was so concerned for Brutus that he worried during the battle that Brutus might be killed on the other side. And he was overjoyed when Brutus was found to be alive. And there were those who believed, from a coming together of circumstances, that Marcus Junius Brutus, in fact, was the natural son of great Caesar. Whatever the reason, Brutus was pardoned, along with many other Roman aristocrats, Roman nobles, who had fought against Caesar, including Gaius Cassius Longinus. He had been pardoned. He had been dealt with through Caesar's great virtue of clementia, clemency. And not only had Brutus and Cassius been pardoned, they had been promoted. And they now held, due to the advancement of Caesar, the offices of praetor in the Roman state. But for many, like Cassius, the very fact that they owed their lives, their promotion to Caesar, was not a cause for clemency, but for hatred. For he had dishonored them by saving their lives. Thus the two fall into conversation, and hearing the cheering from the crowd, Brutus lets drop the statement, "I do fear that the people make Caesar king." "You fear it?" Cassius says, leaping upon it. "I would not have it so." "Why?" "It is not that I do not love Caesar, but I love Rome more," Brutus says. Then Cassius begins to work upon Brutus. He's manipulating him, and Brutus knows this. "I would not, Cassius, yet I love him well. But wherefore do you hold me here so long?" Brutus asked. "What is it that you would impart to me? If it be aught toward the general good, set honor in one eye and death in the other, and I will look upon both indifferently." Set honor in one eye and death in the other. Isn't that what an honorable man does? "For let the gods so speed me that I love the name of honor more than I fear death." Cassius says, "I know that virtue to be in you, Brutus, as well as I do know your outward favor. Well, honor is the subject of my story. I cannot tell what you and other men think of this life, but for my single self, I had as lief not be as live, to be in awe of such a thing as I myself." In other words, I'd rather be dead than to stand in awe before someone no better than I am. "I was born free as Caesar, so were you. We both have fed as well, and we can both endure the winter's cold as well as he. For once upon a raw and gusty day, the troubled Tiber chafing with her shores, Caesar said to me, 'Darest thou, Cassius, now leap in with me into this angry flood and swim to yonder point?' Upon the word, accoutred as I was, I plunged in and bade him follow. So indeed he did, and the torrent roared, and we did buffet it, and with lusty sinews throwing it aside and stemming it with hearts of controversy. But ere we could arrive at the point proposed, Caesar cried, 'Help me, Cassius, or I sink.' And I, as Aeneas, our great ancestor, did from the flames of Troy upon his shoulder the old Anchises bear. So from the waves of the Tiber did I the tired Caesar. And this man is now become a god. And Cassius is a wretched creature and must bend his body if Caesar carelessly, but not on him." Honor. Getting carried away with himself, I'm not sure that honor is not replaced here by jealousy. For Cassius is deeply jealous of Caesar. But even out of jealousy, good can come. Brutus, have you not been getting a series of notes? Yes, and I don't know what to make of them. Notes that read such as, "If the old Brutus were alive, He would drive Caesar out. Don't you understand, Buddhists, that there are so many who think so highly of you that if you would but give the nod, they would join you. Join me in what? In a conspiracy to kill Caesar. No. Think upon it, Brutus. That is all I ask. You lead me into dangerous waters, Cassius. Think upon it. Think upon your honor and the freedom of Rome. Oh, that's a hard thing not to think upon. Your honor for a man of honor like Brutus, for he loves honor more than death, he has told us. And liberty? Why, he is the guardian of the liberty of the Roman people through his great ancestors, those ancestors that mean so much to him, whose bust he sees every day in his house, whose family tree he studies. And his wife, why, she never stops reminding him of her father who died rather than give up honor and liberty. Thinks upon it. And Cassius has begun to manipulate him. And the conspiracy is formed. We know that it consisted of 63 senators, all united together and coming together because of their confidence in Brutus. Without him, it will not work. He is the one man that the people will accept as having done this only out of a sense of duty. So the conspirators come together. And the soothsayer warns great Caesar, beware the Ides of March. But Caesar, as Shakespeare portrays him, is a man of overweening arrogance. A man so sure of the course he has set that he is convinced he cannot be derailed. He has pride, enormous pride, and it must be constantly gratified. And from time to time, a suspicion, as when he sees that Cassius and says, I like fat men around me. I like sleek men. I do not like dangerous thinking men, these thin men who think too much. But it's just a passing notion. He has become convinced that he is too great to be brought down. He chides the soothsayer with his warnings about beware the Ides of March. But they are come. Caesar is not willing to leave the house that day when the senators come to him and ask him to allow them to accompany them to the Senate house. His wife, Calpurnia, has had a dream, a bad dream, and Caesar has promised her that he will stay at home because she has seen great Caesar struck down dead and blood flowing from him like a fountain. Say Caesar will not come because he will not come. Very well. But you know, they were going to offer you the crown today. The crown? Oh, I've got to have that. That little symbol of power. I've got to have it. So off he goes and counters again the soothsayer, you recall. And Caesar says to him, the Ides of March are come. And the soothsayer points out, yes, but they are not yet gone. And there, as we saw in our lecture in famous Romans, great Caesar is struck down by the conspirators. They run out into the street and shout freedom and liberty and enfranchisement to a baffled population, a Roman people that no longer knows what to do with freedom, liberty, and enfranchisement. Baffled, the conspirators began to try to come up with a new game plan, and they must turn to Mark Antony. And Antony is there. And he reaches out his hand and takes their blood-stained hands and shakes them. And they agree to a reconciliation. Caesar's acts will be confirmed, and he will be given a public funeral. And despite the very good sense of Cassius, Caesar is going to be celebrated in the funeral oration by Mark Antony. And in the forum, Caesar's body laid out. Brutus justifies their actions. He loved Caesar, but he loved duty and honor more. Mark Antony rises, this man whom Cassius knows to be clever and Brutus underestimates as a drunkard and a gambler, and makes that powerful oration, "Friends, Romans, and countrymen, lend me your ears. Lend me your ears. I come not to praise Caesar, but to bury him. For the good that men do is oft interred with their bones." Now, Caesar has been slain because Brutus was honorable. You have heard him say that he is an honorable man. Caesar loved Brutus like a son. And Brutus killed him because, after all, Brutus is an honorable man. And Caesar was ambitious. Isn't that what Brutus just told you? Because Caesar was ambitious, I slew him. Caesar was ambitious. Now, I have his will right here, in which he leaves to the Roman people gifts of money and his magnificent gardens along the Tiber. I should somehow think that ambition would be made of sterner stuff than that. And then, manipulating the crowd, "Look at the very cloak that Caesar wears. I was with him on the day he overcame the Nervii, that Gallic tribe," ripping it off. "There are the wounds of great Caesar. If they could but speak to you. But they are dumb mouths now, gaping before you. And there, the unkindest cut of all, where Brutus stabbed him." Anthony has turned the concept of honor around on Brutus. For can any conspiracy be honorable? Are these men of honor? We must flee. And Caesar now carries us rapidly, and again telescoping the events, out to the Far East, to Greece, where the Far East from the Roman perspective, where the armies of Brutus and Cassius, now defending the liberty of the Roman people, must take up arms against Mark Antony and the new arrival on the scene, the young 19-year-old great-nephew of Caesar, Octavius. Caesar, as his contemporaries called him, because his name, after he'd been adopted by Julius Caesar, was Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus. History would know this great winner, this great statesman, as Augustus. Caesar's ghost continues to motivate the action. Brutus sees that ghost, who warns him that they will meet again at Philippi, a place in the north of Greece. Cassius and Brutus have come together, and they have had a falling out. And a bitter set of recriminations occur between them, and then they are reconciled. Cassius swallowing his own honor to get on with this important task of fighting Mark Antony and the young Octavian. But still, Cassius urges that they delay. And Brutus gives that speech that we hear so often quoted about there being a tide in the affairs of men, which if we seize it, leads on to great fortune, and if we ignore it, everything afterwards leaves us in the backwaters. You ought to remember that Brutus gave that speech, and it was a disastrous decision when somebody tells you to seize the moment, to take that tide in your affairs. For the result is death on the field at Philippi, death and defeat, and the suicide of Cassius, and the suicide of Brutus. And over the body of the dead conspirator, this man of honor who had killed great Caesar, who had helped Caesar, who had given him his career and his life, who had betrayed any concept of honor, I believe, by this conspiracy, Anthony gives those words, that this was the noblest Roman of them all, that the elements were so mixed in him, his gentle nature, his virtue, that all the world might say, this was a man. Well, it is indeed a man, and he has all the virtues and flaws of most ordinary men, who disguise, even to themselves, their true motives of envy and jealousy and ambition. And the realist Octavian gives the final summary. For his virtues, let us use him. As he's useful to us, we'll use it. We'll bury him with all honors. And now, let us share the spoils of this happy day. For Shakespeare, honor is but a device that men use, and duty and responsibility but a set of slogans to cloak the eternal lust for power and ambition.